Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Small Business Digest Radio. My name is Don Mazzella, and I am your host for a program devoted to identifying strategies and suggestions to help small business managers increase profits, add sales, better manage cash flow, improve employee management, and streamline operations. Our guests are other entrepreneurs and experts offering their solutions to the problems and opportunities facing small business leaders. Our aim in each program is to provide one or two thought-provoking ideas or suggestions. So follow us on Twitter at #2SBDigest or at our website at www.smallbusinessdigest.net.
You know, today is the anniversary death of newsman that most of you probably never heard of, called H.B. Kaltenberg. And he used to say when he started his program, "We have good news tonight." Well, we have good news tonight. I think we have a very exciting program. And our first guest is David Nielsen. He's co-founder and CEO of Guidant Financial. I know a lot about him, but I'm going to, first off, David, welcome to the program. And as we usually ask our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on the line today. I am, as you said, the co-founder and CEO of a company called Guidant Financial Group. And Guidant's core mission is to increase the number of people that succeed in small business. And the way that we do that is by helping people put intelligent capital to use. I got into this business because I think, like many, many small businesses, and individuals or entrepreneurs, they see chaos in a certain market and they see that as opportunity. And I saw, and my business partner saw, an opportunity for us to help entrepreneurs simplify the process by which they access capital to start or acquire and then grow their businesses. And we started by focusing on, you know, a niche market called rollovers for business startups. And as we, you know, I think gained mastery over that process, expanded into other adjacencies like SBA lending, unsecured credit, and even equipment leasing. And over the course of the past 10 years, we've helped about 10,000 entrepreneurs in all 50 states access $3 billion. And so we're really excited about the success we're seeing there.
Well, you've had great experience in this. First question I'd have is, is there money out there? We hear contradictory stories. And if so, how do you uncover that, the money that could fit you?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is capital available for small businesses. I think the catch, really what you're alluding to, is that, you know, the market's fragmented. There's thousands of capital sources across the country, most of which, you know, your average entrepreneur or small business owner has never heard of. And that's primarily because of the, you know, geography that they live in and who's visible in those marketplaces. But the reality is there's billions of dollars that are sitting on the sidelines ready to invest in small businesses. And so, you know, that's the thing that we work with. I think that over the course of the past 10 years, we've helped to develop relationships with hundreds of financial institutions across the country so that when an entrepreneur needs help identifying a particular lender or a specific capital source that would like to invest in businesses like theirs, that we're able to easily identify that. There are resources on the internet today, companies like BoFly, like Guidant Financial Multifunding. There are organizations out there that have been aggregating these relationships to make it easier and more accessible to the Main Street entrepreneur.
Well, one of the questions that was sent to me, by several people who seem perplexed by this, what are the three things that lenders look for when evaluating a business for a loan?
Sure. Well, as you can probably imagine, it does differ depending on the type of business and the type of capital that's going to work. But maybe I could start at the SBA or even conventional level. So somebody that's going to the bank and saying, I want to get an SBA loan to start this business or buy a franchise. And there's quite a few things that the bank is going to look at. But if I was to try and take that at a high level and say, what are the top three? The first one that comes to mind is certainly credit. You know, the bank's going to want to see that an individual has been able to build and sustain good credit over a long period of time, because they are going to be investing a significant amount of money or providing a significant amount of money to this individual, and they want to make sure that they've got a history of managing good credit. The second would be their equity injection and collateral. So these are, again, large investments for the bank to provide to an individual. They want to make sure that that individual has enough skin in the game to take that investment seriously. And there's really two primary ways that they would do that, and that is requiring them to put a down payment. And generally what you'll see is somewhere around a 25% equity injection. And then they're going to want some security for that loan, and that typically would come in terms of home equity or other large assets that they may own. And the last one is simply the business plan, the model, and specifically the financial projections. The individual has got to demonstrate that they've thought through their market, who their audience or potential customer is, who their competition is, how they'll differentiate themselves in the marketplace, so on and so forth, so that the investment that the individual is receiving from the bank is one that is justifiable.
Well, let's go on. You said that, but now on the other side, a small business person decides that he or she needs money. What are some of the criteria you look people look for in terms of why what the money will be used for, and what are the preferred uses?
Well, generally, the loan proceeds are going to be used for any necessary and ordinary business expense. And that could be to, in the case of a franchise, acquire the rights to use that franchise and go through training to operate that franchise, building out the actual retail location if it's needed, buying the equipment, the inventory to go live, start investing in marketing, and even start paying your staff as you open the doors. You've got to have working capital that allows you enough time to get to profitability. So any of those necessary and ordinary business expenses are generally covered under your traditional loan.
Well, sometimes people, by the time they realize they need money, it's too late. How does one prepare? Should they be looking down the road before they go? I know we often get frantic calls from people. I need money to pay for the new equipment I'm having delivered tomorrow. somewhat of an exaggeration, but not too much. I've actually had a call like that, and I had no answer for him at that time. But they say as a company expands, it needs more and more capital, and sometimes becomes a race to get the capital to keep up with the expansion. How do you plan, or is there a way of planning for obtaining additional capital?
Sure. Well, it's not one size fits all, that's for sure. I think when it comes to capital needs, it's as much an art that it is a science. So I think one of the things that I would recommend to a small business owner or a prospective entrepreneur is that, when they're building their plans, avoid being the eternal optimist. Oftentimes we'll see entrepreneurs come to us and they'll have projections that are very lofty and very aggressive, when in fact I think it's probably in their best interest to be more conservative when it comes to estimating their capital needs, because oftentimes the runway is longer than they think it will be. And then I would reassess those capital needs every 3 to 6 months. I think that's got to be a discipline that every entrepreneur has, because the business will change, as it grows, as it morphs or pivots. its needs for capital will rise and fall. And it's important for them to continue to assess those, because if they wait till the last minute, and this is very common in something that you illustrated in your example there a minute ago, if you wait till the last minute, the power shifts from the individual who's seeking the capital to the institution that is providing it. And the rates, the terms get less friendly to the entrepreneur the closer they get to desperation.
Well, I know that for a fact, having experienced it myself. But now, what does guidance do, and how do you operate? I mean, how do I go to your website? I mean, what's the process that you go through at looking at someone?
Sure. Well, there is quite a few ways. First, we get many people that come to our website and request information, or at least go through the educational content. And we've got, you know, everything from a wizard where people can fill out their, you know, basic financial information just to get a quick quote to understand what kind of financing concepts they may be eligible for. And then we spend time with individuals that want to invest the time. We'll take, an hour with an individual to go through their idea for their business, the general concept of plan, and then try to estimate based on their credit, their financials, and even their business, what type of funding options they have. Now, if someone engages our services, then what we do is we go out to our network of lenders and try to bring multiple LOIs to the table. You know, once our services are engaged, we leverage our lending network to obtain letters of intent. And we're always trying to get at least three lenders to the table because, you know, not to use the old lending free kind of marketing spiel, but their general concept was, when banks compete, you win. And I think the same thing is here. So whenever we have a client, we take them out to our lending sources, and we're trying to get them to compete based on the equity injection, the loan size, the closing costs, the interest rate, the terms, so that, you know, we can show an entrepreneur apples to apples, you know, how those terms are going to impact them in terms of cost of capital and carrying costs.
Well, in some of the loans you've seen in recent days, in recent months, what do you see have been the trends? Are there still loans with variable interest rate pegged to the prime? Are there floors to the interest rate? Well, I guess my real question to ask is, what is the average interest rate being charged to small businesses, if you have a ballpark, if you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going through more of the traditional sources like, conventional SBA lending, it's not uncommon to see those rates somewhere around 6%. So it's relatively inexpensive capital, and those can typically range from, 7 to 10 years from the term standpoint. But when you're looking at things – oh, go ahead.
No, you first. You're doing a better job.
Well, and then you see things like – equipment leases. You know, if someone's buying equipment and they're a startup, you know, they may see interest rates in the teens, whereas an existing business with a very proven track record and maybe even a preferred vendor could be in the, the 8 to 10% range. So, the rates and the terms will vary depending on the perceived risk by the lender. What our role in this is to do is to identify as many opportunities as we can, and then help the candidate to actually demonstrate or put their best foot forward. We want to help the lender understand why our clients should be considered bankable assets.
A lot of people are saying nowadays that you should lease rather than buy. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's it's possible that it's based off of something that Warren Buffett said years ago, when he said, "I buy assets that appreciate, and I lease or rent things that depreciate." And I think there's something to be said for that. You know, it's not uncommon to see when it comes to equipment, something that's going to lose value over time and need to be upgraded, many times per se through a business's lifetime. Those are typically things that you see people leasing versus assets those are things that, you know, people are investing in. So most of our clients, with the exception of equipment, are buying rather than leasing, and that's generally where you see the biggest, you know, the biggest separation between the two.
So I guess, by the way, you're, that's a great one. So you buy assets that you think that will appreciate, but you lease assets that you think will depreciate. In your experience, you've been in this a long time. It almost seems now as if you could start a business, any business, as long as you have a computer, a keyboard, and an internet connection. And then you can almost manage everything on your computer. Are you seeing that happening, and does that affect the amounts of money people need?
We definitely are seeing that. I mean, I think the barrier to entry for entrepreneurs is becoming smaller and smaller as, you know, we continue to gain access to better tools and systems and processes at a lower cost. So, I definitely am seeing that. I think the challenge that is starting to arise, though, is that with these businesses that are, you know, more digital than retail, it's harder to estimate a value from a financial institution standpoint. So it's helpful in the marketplace where you have angel and you're trying to raise capital for a startup, but the bank is going to have a harder time estimating value and will be likely more stringent about it. So the digital businesses become harder to lend to in startup phase, for sure. But what we're seeing good traction is in, you know, your what I consider your more main street American small businesses, the retail locations, the, you know, the maid service down the street, the Subway sandwich store, the fast science business. Those types of organizations are, you know, still very crucial to, you know, our economy thriving, small businesses getting the services and the individuals getting the personal services that they need. And those are the ones that, you know, there's insatiable demand to finance.
I saw a study come across my desk yesterday that said that there are more entrepreneurs who are approaching or past retirement age who are trying to sell their business, and that one of the reasons they're not able to sell it is because the people that want to buy it can't find financing. Do you want to talk about that and give us your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think at the beginning of the show, I made the comment that we jumped into this business to solve what we saw as a chaotic problem that has dramatic impacts on, you know, small business owners and our economy. Access to capital, or at least the perception of access to capital, is challenging. So I'm not surprised to see that. I think banks today learned some lessons from the crash of 2008, and that is that they need to be a little bit more stringent about the way they underwrite these transactions. And about providing capital to those that have shown that they are responsible in managing that type of credit. So, yeah, I mean, we certainly are seeing that they are spending more time, but for qualified borrowers, financing is possible. I think that's one of the ways that we are improving that experience for entrepreneurs, because the general premise or general way that an individual would seek capital is they would go to their own bank, the person that they have a checking and savings account with. And they would tell this banker, hey, I want a loan. I want $300,000 to buy this business. And the banker is going to either tell them yes or no. And more times than not, it's a no. But we're taking that same individual out to multiple financing sources and looking for someone who wants to consume that type of loan or provide a loan to that type of individual in that geographic territory. So we dramatically increase the number of people who are able to obtain credit because we give them access to more sources. And, yeah, you are seeing the baby boomers who currently own businesses starting to exit those. And in order for them to be able to do that, they have to have buyers who can access credit. The kind of old-school way of accessing credit doesn't work the way that it used to, and it's time for both entrepreneurs and small business owners to adopt a new way of thinking.
David, we're talking with David Nilsen. He's co-founder and CEO of Guidance Financial. We have to invite you back. I see our next guest is ready to join us. But first, tell people how they can reach you and your company.
You bet. We're on the line, just like everyone else, at guidantfinancial.com. That's GUIDANTfinancial.com, or toll free at 888-472-4455.
We repeat it again for our audience?
You bet. It's guidantfinancial.com. It's GUIDANTfinancial.com, and then 888-472-4455. And we provide free consultations to those who are interested in understanding how they might be able to finance a small business. We'd be happy to talk to any of your listeners.
David, please come back again and talk some more. I learned a lot, and I hope our audience did.
I'd be happy to, and thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. Our next guest is Tom Caparasso. He's CEO of Claris Marketing Group. And what I really found fascinating about this is he believes that small and large companies can build sales and customize through customized subscription programs. And I'm really looking forward to hearing him. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Tom, we always ask our guests first to tell us a little bit about yourself personally before we get into the topic.
Sure. So I've been in the online subscription direct marketing space for the last 20-plus years, really focused on driving customer acquisition into either subscription products, continuity products, membership programs, loyalty programs. So a lot of my experience has been about really direct marketing, acquiring customers, and ultimately getting them engaged in a subscription-like program that drives value, you know, repeat purchase, average order value, everything like that. So that's really where my experience lies over the last 20-plus years.
Well, first, for our audience, let's define what you mean by subscription programs and the other three that you mentioned, because I know I'd like to know the differences. So if you wouldn't mind starting there, it'd be helpful.
Sure. So you know, there's definitely different types of programs. I'll start with subscription. A subscription could be anything, you know, from an old school newspaper subscription to, you know, my grandmother getting milk delivered on her stoop back in the day, where you're paying either an annual or a monthly, biannual, quarterly fee, and you're getting an ongoing service. So that would be subscription. Continuity is much. There's a lot of different continuity programs out there now. You know, a Birchbox is a great example, or a Dollar Shave Club, where you're getting actually a physical good, maybe the same thing every month, maybe something different, but it's really a kind of a continuity program. You signed up, and you signed up to get something different, something the same every month. So that could be coins, that could be collectibles, that could be razor blades, that could be perfume, but you're getting something every month. And then really the third bucket is the loyalty / membership bucket, where, you know, I'll kind of put those in the same bucket. It's really around a product or a service that typically you're either signing up for free or signing up for a fee, and you're getting access to benefits. Those benefits could be free shipping, they could be return shipping, it could be a cashback product. It could be streaming video. It could be a lot of different things, but it's really based around a membership into something or loyalty for a specific retailer.
Well, that was about as complete as I've heard, and thank you.
Sure.
No, I think it's important. By the way, you mentioned several subscriptions. I actually saw one the other day that talked about giving you a new socks each month. They're actually on a, I found that fascinating. Now, having said that, I'm a small business. 59% of our audience are small business owners.
Sure.
And or presidents. How do they get into it? And, well, the first question is, why should they get into it?
Yeah, well, for a small business, you can get into it, small, medium, large business. It's any type of subscription model is something that you want to drive consumers in, you want to give them value. For a small business, the beauty of a subscription model is the recurring revenue that you'll generate on an ongoing or monthly basis. So depending on what your business does, again, it could be any one of those three areas that we talked about earlier, but you know that once you acquire a customer, they're in the program, and then you have a recurring revenue stream each month. So if you can acquire the customer at a good rate and get them into the program and then drive value into the program, drive stickiness and engagement in the program, the consumers are ultimately going to stay with the program, and that's where you're going to make your money, through that recurring revenue model. So rather than go out and – yep, go ahead.
I'd like you to stop you there. How do you provide stickiness and value? That's the question that was sent to me when they saw that you were coming on the program.
Yeah, so value can be derived from a lot of different areas, and it's really important to understand what your customers need and want. And so each customer base or program could be a little bit different, but value can be, you know, buy one, get one. It could be a 10% off coupon. It could be free shipping for someone who joins the program. It could be return shipping as another benefit. As more and more of these products grow, you know, you're starting to see streaming video embedded into some of these products. So they can all be very different, but it's really understanding what your customer base is craving. They may be craving free shipping and free returns, and you could build a whole program around that and really build a prepaid shipping program so that you're acquiring a customer and that they're getting access to free shipping offers and return shipping offers each month or an ongoing basis. So, again, the beauty of a subscription model is that you're acquiring them once, and then you're getting that recurring revenue each month versus acquiring a new customer every single month. Once you get one, and again, you get it for the right price, you back into an effective cost per acquisition that works for your model, you then can very easily start to build out a lifetime value of that customer by driving value in the program and ultimately having them stay around.
Well, would one of these programs, I noticed that the local diner that I go to, I have a friend that we meet about once or twice a week, now has an app on your on the smartphone that each time you go in, you hit it, and you get, after 7 visits, you get a free dessert, and after 25 visits, you get a free dinner. Is that the type of thing you're talking about?
It could be, that could be exactly it. That's really built on kind of a repeat purchase model. It could be points based. It could be, you know, get a free cup of coffee when you come in for the next 5 times. It really depends on what you're trying to do with your customers. What is the goal of the program? You know, we work with a lot of different clients, and part of our first step before we ever really come to them with an idea is just understand and analyze their business and where are their pain points, what are their kind of key metrics that they're trying to drive to. That could be repeat customers in a diner. That could be driving your average order value up online. All the different clients that we work with are a little bit different. But having a much more customized program based on those metrics that you're trying to either hit or improve on is really the key around a loyalty or subscription product.
Well, I did a little checking on you, as I do with many of our guests, and you have your company, Claris Marketing Group, has a very good reputation. But what's the level? You don't take on mom and pop stores, do you?
We work with you know, very small retailers to the largest retailers in the world and the largest financial institutions in the world, like MasterCard. But we have, you know, small retailers, medium sized retailers, and we also work with the Walmart and Kohl's of the world. really the model that we have is a loyalty slash kind of prepaid shipping model, because we work with so many online retailers, and our product that we market to a lot of those customers is called freeshipping.com. And that is really kind of our off-the-shelf product that we work with a lot of different retailers. We have another side of our business that really takes our platform that powers freeshipping.com and customizes it for our retail clients. So we have, you know, smaller catalogs that we drive their loyalty programs for, and then we have a subscription program that we run for MasterCard. So we really kind of run the gamut from, you know, small, medium, and large. The beauty of, again, the subscription model is that once you understand what any size retailer or financial institution is looking for, you can really build a program. And that's really where our strength is at Claris, is understanding that, adapting to that, and ultimately building the right solution for the right client.
Well, I know, this week has been an interesting week because I've never gotten as many emails for questions. And I guess the one that most seems to come up with, how do you measure the cost versus the benefits of your programs like yours?
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to, one, understanding your metrics before you ever go into a subscription product. So again, your metrics can be repeat purchases. They could be average order value. They could be, you know, driving someone into a store to make a purchase. So that's really the first step, is benchmarking where you are today and then what's important for you to move, and what, you know, if you're going to charge a subscription, what is that value of that subscription or charge to the consumer? And then ultimately, what's the value in the program? So, yeah, I'll give you an example. For instance, if you're trying to drive your average order value up and you know it's at $50, you could drive a free shipping deal that's tied to a $60 threshold as part of the program. Or you can give it free shipping all the time and just try to drive repeat purchases. So it's really important to benchmark where you're at before you start. And then you do a kind of a cost-benefit analysis of, hey, if you wanted to give away this promotion, it was going to cost you $2, but you're ultimately going to drive a repeat purchase or two or three, whatever that number is. You know, you have to do that analysis of what that subscription will be, what the cost of benefits will be, and ultimately what the ultimate value is to the consumer, and will they use it, engage it, and stay with the program.
Go ahead.
You know, our piece of the puzzle is really, we do a lot of data-driven analysis. We do all of our decision-making is based on data, both really pre putting a program in place, and then understanding and reading the data, and then optimizing the program on a go-forward basis. The thing about subscription programs is that it's not a set and forget. You continually need to be looking at where your consumers are using the program, what benefits do they like, what benefits aren't they using, and continue to optimize the benefit mix, as well as, you know, we're doing a lot more with our clients and with our own programs around personalization. So if I know that you, you know, bought a red sweater, for instance, I want to populate a lot of information around red sweaters, or a specific brand like Under Armour clothes you bought in the past. We want to drive you know, a specific offer that we might have gotten from Under Armour to all those customers that are Under Armour wearers. So things like that, where you can really personalize it and bring that nice touch to the customer that really says, hey, we know what you want, we understand it, and we're going to give you a great offer to drive another repeat purchase. That's the things that we're really kind of digging into, and that's all really hidden in the data, and you got to dig in there and get it.
Well, Tom, I want you to just stop for 1 minute. We have someone waiting, and I wasn't scheduled. Hello from 248. Who is here? Hello? Hello, this is, is she there, but not answering. So I didn't mean to interrupt you, Tom. You were doing so
okay.
well. But let's hope they stay on, and when we finish with you, we'll go back.
Sure.
Our next guest wasn't scheduled for another 10 minutes. That's why I was surprised. And they've been on for a while. But what we may have is, and I thought it might be someone here with a question. Nope, just went away. But anyway, you know, you're interesting you brought that up. I bought an undergarment for outfit for my wife, and now about 3 months ago for an occasion, and now I'm being inundated by that particular store as if I'm a woman.
Right. Yeah, that's the birth of kind of retargeting online. I don't know if you bought it online. I'm sure you did, but yeah, that is, you are now kind of labeled in that database as buying that product, and ultimately their goal is going to be to get you to buy more. Now, it sounds like yours might have been a one-time event, and maybe retargeting isn't the right fit, but you know, that really goes to the personalization of what's going on online. So, you know, even if you visited a page and looked at a specific item, you're going to start to see that item kind of follow you all around the web. It could be Facebook, it could be on the newspaper that you're reading. You're going to see that whatever Under Armour shoe because you went to that page and looked at it, and they're going to follow you. And you know, ultimately, you're either going to make that purchase or not. But retargeting definitely shows that you had interest in a specific item. And ultimately, they're looking for a conversion downstream, and they're going to try to follow you around because they know you're interested, and ultimately you may see it two or three or four times and then say, okay, now I'm ready to buy that shoe. Where that model falls apart seems like it's in your specific example where you bought something for your wife, and it's maybe a one-time event, not something you're going to buy on an ongoing basis. But that's really kind of what's happening online, is really that retargeting and following you around and trying to ultimately get a sale from you.
Well, that's I'll just give you one more example. I keep being targeted for garage floor paint, and I haven't figured that one out. But our guest is back. Let me just invite, I believe. Hello, from area code 248. Who's calling?
Yes, good evening. This is Brian Ray. I was asked to call at 8:30.
Oh, okay. Be patient with us, and we'll get to you, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you.
We're kind of an informal program. I don't have an engineer for my program, so I do it all myself. And I also do the scheduling, and sometimes I double schedule.
Yeah, no problem.
No, you're doing great. And but now, I'm a small business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this all seems like a lot of stuff that big business would do. How can we drill it down a little bit and give some advice to smaller businesses?
Yeah, I guess the first piece of information I'd give is really try to gather as much information as you can on your current customers. And it could be as informal as asking them when they're in their store, or if you're running an online website, just understanding how they're interacting with the site. I mean, you can use free tools like Google Analytics to understand where people are coming into the site, where people are interacting with the site, what pages they're looking at. That's a free tool today that's very easy to put in onto your website. So ultimately getting all that information and then really trying to digest that information and kind of find the nuggets that are in there that are positive and that you really want to move the needle. So I would always start with the data, try to understand the data the best you can, try to garner as much data as you can. And once you have all that together, then you really will start to see some trends kind of walk through that data. And ultimately from those trends, you could say, hey, here's what I'm thinking for a loyalty program, a subscription program, a prepaid shipping program, whatever it might be. And here are the kind of the core benefits. I mean, that's something that we do at Claris all the time with our clients, again, big and small, but and trying to really help them navigate that, that understanding of the data, and ultimately making decisions based on that.
I was just taking care of a caller who brought in a question.
Okay.
Tom,
yes.
Their question to you was, I'm trying to phrase it in a better way than she did, but I'll say it. When should a company consider this? When they first start off business or when they're more mature?
That's a great question. It really can be either. I guess it's probably the more mature, just because you need to understand your customer base first, and understand how they're interacting with your product or service. And once you have that benchmark, then you can really start to dig into what a program might look and feel like. So it's hard to start, a brand new business without any data. So I would always say get the data first, understand what and how they're using your product and service, and then start to build a program or product around that. And that could be any of the things that we talked about earlier. But I'd always start with the data. So I'd say a little bit more mature. And once you start understanding those customers, then you're going to make an educated decision.
Okay. Tom, if people want to reach you or your company, how do they do it?
Sure. So the company, again, is Claris Marketing Group. The company website is clarismarketing.com. That's spelled C-L-A-R-U-S marketing.com. And all of our contact information, contact form, can be found on the site.
Tom, we want you to come back another time and talk some more. Because
sure,
you've really been enlightening to us. And I
Great.
Really thank you for coming on and putting up with these interruptions.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. And please, come again.
Will do. Have a great night.
Our next guest is Lee Odess of Brevo. Hello? Well, you've been waiting. Now we've got you on, and you're not here. Lee, are you here? Well, we'll take a short break from one of our sponsors, and then we'll see if Lee comes back on.
Just how dangerous is social networking? Use of websites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are all the rage. But what are the downsides of this new technology? The incidents of bullying, stalking, harassment, and inappropriate content are increasing. Just how dangerous is it? What can you do to protect your child and yourself from it? Go to ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for a free hour-long video on the dangers of social networking. That's ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for your free hour-long video.
Hello.
Hi, sir. Leo Dess. How are you?
I'm pretty good. We have another guest who's been on and off.
Somebody else. I was listening to the podcast, and somebody else called in.
Right. Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
You're here to talk about why small businesses need physical security. I thought it was a really interesting subject. No one had brought it up that I had seen, and I thought that we should have you on the program. But as we ask every guest, tell us a little bit about yourself personally before we get into anything else.
Sure. So before I came to Brevo as the vice president of marketing, I had a small business myself locally with my wife. We were an audio video design and installation company in the Washington, D.C. market. and we also owned a catering company. So both of us had our own businesses at the same time, and decided the catering was a bit much from what we wanted to do, and the AV company was taking off. So we focused there and ended up selling that about 3 years ago. And then I came on to Brevo as a used to sell the product, and so I was familiar with it, and I've been there since.
Well, okay. And you're in the Washington, D.C. area, 301, I see.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the Maryland.
Well, all right. Now, having said that, tell us why a small business needs physical security.
Well, sure. So, depending on what type of business you are, really, the physical building itself of keeping just the peace of mind side of things. So not just locking it up, but then you notice you spent a lot of time there, you spent some time out of it, but keeping the assets that you have protected, as well as if you're not there, the ability to have a sort of keep an eye on the facility. So through things like video and whatnot, to protecting not only the employees, but then also customers, depending on if the business is a 24/7 type business, the peace of mind aspect and protection of the space and the assets that you have is one big reason why people utilize security systems.
Well, with the internet, I happen to be on the board of a medical marijuana facility here in New Jersey, and we have cameras every place, all linked to the state police and all over the place. We really have to be protected. But how does one? I have a store. I guess what it's saying. What is the minimum that I should be doing if I have a store? In terms of physical.
Sure. There's three aspects of the stool, really. There's intrusion, which is what most people think of security, which is the alarm that goes off if, say, somebody breaks in. So that's one area. The second one is video. And you're seeing a lot of people utilize hosted video, so cloud-based video. But they also make on-premise video systems, so that's using cameras to take video. And then the third would be access control, which is, if you think of it, almost as digital keys. So either on cards or now people are utilizing their phones to enter into their buildings.
Well, but should you have cameras in every place except the bathroom? Or give us how you would go about this working with a potential customer.
Sure, and I can tell you my own personal experience of the space that we had, which in some areas we had merchandise in the back. And if you're retail dealing with money, there might be an office that you have where you keep records and say, you know, from payments or your employees. So you have different offices. So you have the perimeter of the space, if you would. So if there's a door to enter, it could be the dark delivery door if you're a restaurant in the back, or it could be the one front door that all your employees come through. So you'd want to at least do the doors that you have on the perimeter. And then interior, you would do you can think of them almost as high-value spaces, like I said, where you have records possibly or merchandise. So at a minimum, you'd want to arm those doors. And then from the camera side of things, really depends on how you use the space. If it's a public space, where people can come in and out, we typically see people do cameras at the doors so they can keep track of who is coming and who's going. And then usually a wider lens, say for the overall open space. And then anywhere that you have inside rooms where not only do you want to know who's coming and going, but able to do a visual recognition of that person. So at a minimum, typically we see anywhere from 2 to 4 doors on the smaller side, and then 2 to 4 cameras typically. And then it just grows from there. So that's usually the beginning.
Well, I got an email about your coming on, and the question they asked is, how long should you, A, should you tape that, and B, how long should you keep the tapes, or the, in this case, discs nowadays?
Sure. And actually, I'll take it one step further to having it stored in the cloud. So in some aspects, you don't even have to have a physical tape locally that you would do that. And on average, so we offer everything from live to 15-day to 30, 60, 90, and then we do 1 year. The majority of our customers purchase the 30 days, and that's thousands and thousands of people. So if you use that data point, majority of people are doing anywhere from 30 days is on average.
Well, it was very interesting. We had, because we in our facility have 24-hour and we keep records, we have to keep records from day one. We heard of an incident in another facility where they were able to prove that there was no sexual harassment. Is that a byproduct? In a, and is that a, obviously it's a good thing, but do you see that as an advantage?
Yeah, so that's actually, you know, people typically go straight to the peace of mind when they're thinking of these systems, but there's a couple other things that happen out of it. Number one is verification of stuff like that. We have actually a customer in Chicago that we talked to that was trying to figure out where theft was happening and ended up being able to watch the video to see actually an employee taking from the register. And then actually when they had someone steal a bike, they were able to utilize that tape right away, pull the clip and email it actually over to the police station. So the speed of being able to do verification was there. We also see people like to use the ability to manage their business from not being physically on site. So say you're at home. I know, for instance, I was able to use the video system from my old business when my employees would be at the office and the guy had to pull a certain type of wire from the storage unit and he would use the camera to show me so I can do, I can visually see it instead of me having to pack up and drive down to the office. So I was able to manage it remotely. We also have a couple retail customers that we know have used it to where, say, a manager was late to open the door to let the employees in and customers. So instead of having to drive to Southern California, they were able to remotely from their phone unlock the door. And then we have a gym, too. I know that they use this. They used to be only open from, you know, 6 a.m. to like 7 p.m. at night, and they made a business decision to go 24/7. And how they did that was they handed out key cards to their customers, and they were able to then take advantage of after hours and weekends. So they turned into a 24/7 gym.
Wow. That's really interesting. The internet sure has changed the world, hasn't it?
in many, many ways, yes.
Well, let's talk now about your company. Tell us a little bit about, because we're running a short on time.
Sure, not a problem. So, happy to do that. So, yeah, Brevo started 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We started actually from a SaaS model. So, we're the only cloud-based access control system where everybody typically has client server type computer systems on site. We actually utilize the cloud. So all of the benefits that you get from SaaS tools, we see that in the physical security space. We're worldwide. We have a network of over 300 dealers that resell our product in the marketplace. And we, like I said, we do access control, we do video. And yeah, you could find us anywhere, really.
Okay. And your website?
Yes, brivo.com, brivo.com.
Okay. Well, Lee, I'm going to have to say thank you tonight. We have other people coming on board, and the switchboard is lighting up. So.
No problem. I appreciate the opportunity.
No, and we're going to have you back again to talk more. All right?
Would love to. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Ariel, are you on?
I am on.
Okay, but there's somebody else on from 617.
And, that means they're in Boston.
I'm trying to get them to... you're on air. Hello.
Hello, this is Jordan Fliga with Coach.
Okay. John, I see we have double booked again. My audience is used to that with me by now, I hope. But if you will hold on, I have Ariel coming, and then we're going to go over to have your have you on. So can you stay with us for a while?
Sure.
This is Ariel's spot, but I will be back to you, I promise. Okay?
Okay, no problem.
I'm going to... Ariel, we've had a very interesting night tonight. We've had people coming on and off. It's really been something.
Yes, I've been listening in. It certainly has been something.
But Ariel, you join us to talk about your new book, CrowdStart. And I've sent you a couple of emails from people that didn't want to wait for the show, but wanted to talk to you before the show. I hope you got them.
They've been calling the office all day today, indeed.
So that's good to hear. First, let's give a little bit about your background, and then we'll go into your subject a little bit more thoroughly. And I promise I'm going to invite you back very soon to finish this conversation, because I want to keep I don't want to keep our other guests waiting. So tell us a little bit about yourself and about your book and about social media trends.
Sure. So a little bit about myself. I've been running a digital PR firm for, since before social media even was coined the term social media. We work with creative entrepreneurs and small businesses, and we help them find their voice online, get exposed to the blogosphere, and help them with social media strategy. And I'm a strong believer that if you're invisible online in 2015, you better not be anymore, because if you're not, you're going to be left behind. So we help our clients navigate the best social sites and figure out how to become influencers in their domains and connect with the right customers.
But how did you figure it out so early?
I was a traditional publicist, and I started my traditional firm in the mid-90s. And I was working with a demographic of clients who were the first on the chopping block when the death of traditional media started happening. So as the newspapers were getting minimized and the entertainment reporters were getting downsized, my clients were the first on the chopping block because we were representing mostly independent musicians at the time. And I realized that there was no future for that type of work. And so I started looking for other ways that I could promote my artists. Back then, also MP3.com and the rampant stealing of intellectual property of artists began happening. And I realized, oh boy, we better do something, because if we can't beat them, we might as well join them. So that's how I started. It was absolutely out of necessity. And it turns out I love social media marketing and the way of connecting really resonated with me. And so I became an early adopter and rode the right waves, basically.
Well, now, but why did you come to write a book on cloud funding?
Well, my first two books are all about social media marketing and how to do it effectively. And a couple of years ago, about 18 months ago, I did my own crowdfunding campaign, and I raised $62,000, which for a small business was very exciting, and it helped me do a lot of things that, as an entrepreneur that had always bootstrapped my company, I hadn't been able to do. And I realized how powerful it was. But I also realized how much work it takes. And there's a lot of conflicting information out there about how to do crowdfunding. Websites like Kickstarter and Indiegogo and GoFundMe and all the others you may have heard of, the interfaces are quite simple and elegant, and it looks like, oh, I'll just sign up and I'll get all the money I want just by asking. And it's actually a little bit more involved and complicated than that. So as the gal who has been known to simplify things that feel complicated, I decided to take on writing a 30-day roadmap to crowdfunding, which is what CrowdStart will be.
Well, is the book available now? Because I sure could use it, and I certainly, judging by the audience and the emails I'm getting, there's a lot of interest.
Actually, the book is in its final stages of editing right now, so it will be available this spring.
Well, you're going to find me on the list as well. But if people wanted to talk to you and get a head start, how do they do it?
Well, you can read articles that I've written and find out a lot about what we do and get some tips at cyberpr, cyberpr.com.
Well, and if they want to reach you directly now, because that's what they're all asking for.
Twitter is the best way to get me. I'm cyberpr. And if you'd like to get in touch in a more formal way, every single possible way you can get me is widely available at cyberpr.com.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do, Ariel. The week or the month that the book is published, we're going to have you back, and then we're going to have we're going to devote a half hour to the book and you, and we're going to go through it page by page.
Well, that sounds exciting. I look forward to that.
Okay, because I'm going to take this next caller, because we're already past the hour, but thankfully we can go to 9:30. And but I definitely want you back. And
well, thank you very much. We'll be in touch. I hope the rest of the show is not quadruple booked.
Well, it's my fault. Okay,
Cheers.
My fault, and my producer hasn't been on this week, and I've had to do it. So let me go to our last guest, and we'll definitely stay in contact.
Sounds good.
Our final guest, hopefully, can introduce himself, because I don't have you on the schedule.
So,
hello.
Okay. Hello. It's Jordan Flegel, founder and president of Coach Up. Coach Up is the nation's leading sports coaching company. We connect athletes with private coaches all across the country.
Well, thank you for your patience.
Sure.
I have you scheduled for next week, but that's okay. We'll have you on now. I found that if I recall what we discussed, and by the way, you help match, if I understand it correctly, match coaches to athletes. Did I get it right?
Yeah, that's right. So if you are a parent and you have a child who plays basketball or soccer or football, any sport really, anything from those major sports on through yoga and dance and fitness, you go on to coachup.com and you enter where you live, what sport you're looking for instruction in, either for yourself or for your child. And we show you the best trainer in the area that are on our system, that are vetted, background checked, reviewed. And we handle everything from payments to scheduling, mobile apps, to make sure that you're connected with the right coach and to make sure that you get the most out of your training.
Well, I noticed the pro athletes use coaches, and there's even here in New Jersey two or three major facilities where they teach potential NFL draft choices how to better themselves in the trials, which just ended last week. But how did you get into this?
Sure. Yeah. Great question. So actually, I was an athlete. I
was a basketball player, wasn't very good, was on the freshman team as a freshman in high school. And over the summer, a camp counselor agreed to work with me one-on-one, and he became my private coach. He had played collegiate basketball. And through his instruction, I was able to make varsity as a sophomore, become a starter on varsity as a sophomore. And I kept working with him every summer, and I went from really being a very average high school in college and then playing professionally overseas in New York.
Well,
coach as well.
Keep going. No. I don't want to interrupt. I sometimes interrupt when I shouldn't. But
I had this great experience. Not only did I become a better basketball player, but I also became a much more confident person. I became better at school. My parents saw a real transformation in me as a player and as a person. And I actually became a really good student. And I think the work ethic that my basketball coach instilled in me spilled over to other areas of my life, academics, to my professional life and business now. And I want to have that same impact as a mentor, as a coach, and other basketball players in my hometown. And so for the past 10 years, I've been doing private instruction. Kids ranging from, you know, grade school to high school on up through professional players I coach. Yes, go ahead.
Well, are you primarily high school, college, or is it all levels?
Yeah, so, well, you know, on Coach Up, I realized that I wasn't, you know, the real problems with the system. It's hard to find good coaches and know that they're safe and background checked and high quality. There's all sorts of variables that go into the decision-making process: price, distance, location, availability. And as a coach, it's really hard to market and manage your business. On CoachUp, we have 13,000 coaches now across the country. We have over 100,000 athletes who use our service. We conduct hundreds of training sessions every day, all across the country. So we have, we're really number one company now in the sports coaching industry, which is a very highly fragmented industry before CoachUp. But the kids or the athletes who use CoachUp, it's a wide range. Again, everywhere from grade school and high school, which is the majority of our clients, on up to college and professional athletes, as well as adults who are looking to lose weight or get in shape or learn how to play tennis or improve their golf playing or whatever it might be.
Well, I found it fascinating that you were able to identify a need and supply it. But there's an old axiom in marketing that supply a need and you'll make money, supply a desire and you'll make a fortune. Generally, why do parents want coaches? What are the two or three main reasons that you think?
Well, number one, the number one topic of conversation typically around a dinner table in which you have kids who play sports tends to be the sports. It's something that's really enjoyable for the kids. They love playing sports. They're passionate about sports. If you know soccer moms and little league dads, they're really passionate about their child's participation in sports. It's a very American tradition. It's something that really can connect the whole family. So it never made sense to me that something that's so competitive and so skill-based as sports impacts on a young person's life, not only in the game, but what the game teaches you, that we never really had help for our kids. That it was expected that in school you'd get a tutor, but in sports it was up to dad to take son out back and show him how to throw a football or shoot a basket. And CoachUp's changed that. There's a lot of studies and data that show that coaches are more influential in the development of a child's life than even their teachers. Sports is really a vehicle that you can learn a lot through. And so coaches are really, really impactful, so important in our kids' lives. And I think it's a very natural tendency for parents to want to support their kids and want to help them develop as people, as adults. And sports is a big part of that. And coaching is really interesting. It's a highly fragmented $6 billion industry in which we said, you know, even though coaches are so important, there's no standards, there's no reviews, there's no background checks, there's no platform that makes sure that coaches are good and coaches are responsive and that they deliver a good service. That's not true in the taxi industry. That's not true in the industry. It's not true in tutoring and academic industries, but we're changing that in coaching.
Do you do background checks on these coaches?
We do.
And do you on occasion bar coaches from being on your site?
We do. So we have an internal coach selection committee. I should mention we've raised $10 million in venture capital, 25 full-time employees at our headquarters who do nothing but improve the product and deliver great customer service. We have an internal team that reviews all applications from coaches. We work closely with professional leagues. We have thousands of former NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, Major League Soccer players on Coach Up. We're directly helping solve a major problem, which is for professional athletes when you're done playing, you want to stay involved in your sport, but you're not necessarily great at building a website or marketing your service. What do you do when you're playing? How do you stay involved in your sport, give back, make a living, doing something that you love? Who's the vehicle for that? But our coach selection committee ensures that coaches are safe, they pass background checks, that they've played or coached at extremely high level. And we have all sorts of data that we track, data that no one else in the coaching industry tracks, like real verified reviews by clients, retention rate for coaches, average number of sessions that coaches do with clients. And so we're able to really apply data to that. We have a gamified system, so coaches earn points, coach score points, if they get good reviews and deliver great service. And that moves up in our leaderboard rankings. So we've ranked actually all the coaches in America on our system for their sport and in their state and nationally based on how good of a service they deliver. So what we've done for the coaching industry has never been done before.
How do you make your money? Do you take a commission from the coaches or from the parents?
From the coach. So when that happens, we take a percentage as our fee. In return, we're providing the technology, the websites, the insurance on every training session for the coach, ongoing marketing and customer support capabilities. We have iPhone and Android apps for them to manage their business on the go. We do scheduling and everything for them. So we try to make it really, really simple for the athlete or the parent to find the perfect coach and for the coach to manage their business so that they can focus on doing what they love, which is coaching kids.
And then your website?
CoachUp.com.
Can you spell it out for our...
CoachUP.com.
Okay. Can they reach you via the website, or do you have a number?
Absolutely. And feel free to shoot me an email. I deal directly with clients and coaches all the time myself. It's really important that we deliver great service. I actually use our website to train currently in boxing and in tennis, and I continue to coach athletes in basketball. So my life story is Coach Up, and I'm a huge believer in our product and our service. Send me an email, J, just the letter J, at coachup.com. Happy to hear from anyone who has any questions about our service directly. You can also go to our website, coachup.com. Or email us at support@coachup.com as well. You could also call us, 888-680-4750.
How long have you been in business?
Since 2000, and we launched in 2012.
What?
So we've grown very, very quickly in just over 3 years, not even 4 years now.
Well, I know that when we did the background check on you. We were very impressed by your progress, and that's why we wanted you on the program. We thought you were next week, but we're glad you came this week. And we want you back in the fall when everybody starts looking at football and the World Series and everything, and we'll talk about it then.
I'd love to come back on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be more organized by then.
Okay, but, sure thing. But, appreciate it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for what I really interesting. The nice thing about this show is I get to talk to a lot of interesting people, and you're one of the more interesting ones that we've had. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Have a good night.
Thank you for listening tonight. All of our guests are invited because they offer actionable advice to our audience. They do not pay to join us, but rather demonstrate their capacity for helping our audience add profits. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here again next week with other experts to talk about ways to improve your profit picture. Remember, we're here every week at blogtalkradio.com/smallbusinessdigest. If you like what you heard today, tell others about our efforts. If you would like to be a guest or suggest topics for future hours, email me at info@smallbusinessdigest.net. That's info@smallbusinessdigest.net. We would also like to remind listeners that besides our radio efforts, Small Business Digest comes to you via the web, through our video channel, and in our magazine. You can subscribe for any or all of these by going to smallbusinessdigest.net. That's smallbusinessdigest.net. Thank you, and have a good day.